Okay, I think we might begin. My name is Suki Pax, and I'm chairing this session. And just before we begin the session, I just want to let, or we want to let people know that the media we think are present. They were certainly present earlier, and this is a public event, and of course the media are welcome. But we thought we should let you know the media are here. Okay, in this session, critical impacts. The presenters will outline and discuss the impacts of social inequality on health from Fran Baum and on education from Jen Scatterbowl. And the last speaker, Rosanna Scutella, will address social exclusion in Australia. And each speaker, as before, has got 30 minutes, 20 minutes for the presentation and 10 for questions and discussion. But it's with great pleasure that I introduce Fran Baum. Fran is the Matthew Flinders Distinguished Professor and an ARC Federation Fellow at Flinders University and a member of the Academy of Social Sciences in Australia. She's one of Australia's leading researchers on the social and economic determinants of health and a member of the Global Steering Council on the People's Health Movement. Welcome, Fran.
Good morning, everybody. It's great to be here, and I'd like to acknowledge the Ngunnawal people, the traditional owners of the land, and acknowledge their resilience through the processes of colonisation and pay respects to their elders past and present. What I'm going to talk about is how can we take action on health equity? There's been a lot of work looking at describing health equities, and I really want to think about how we understand it really matters to action. Our understanding drives the form of action, what we might do, what the barriers are to doing those things, and then finally just thinking about civil society action that hopefully will force governments to take action on the inequities we've already heard about. So to think first of all, I think at the moment how we understand health inequities is we tend to have a focus on the disadvantaged. We tend to focus just on increasing wealth, and we tend to have a very, within the health field, we have a very strong epidemiological focus. And I think we really need to think more about, well, what's a gradient? How do we flatten gradients? Focus on what you do with wealth, so it's not just about how much wealth you've got, but what you do with it. And finally, having a sociological imagination to really look at what's happening with health inequities, as well as an economist imagination and maybe an epidemiological one. Of course, in Australia, we have one of the highest life expectancies in the world, particularly for females. We all know about the gap between Indigenous and non-Indigenous health status, which has to be a key part of the health equity considerations in Australia. But across the population, health equity is really about a gradient. It's not just those at the bottom. The highest SES group do much better than the fourth, third, and second, and the lowest. So I think we need to think about that, and that our policy objective should be levelling up, acting across the whole population, not just saying, how can we focus on the poorest 20%? It's actually about levelling up that gradient, or at least that's what I think the policy. The other crucial thing is it's not just about money and level of wealth, it's what's to be done about this. And there is an epidemiology of inequality which is growing. Richard Wilkinson is one of those, but also Kawachi at Harvard and others. And of course, the reasons why equity may be good for us is that it perhaps goes along with more just social policies, leads to greater cohesion, greater solidarity. And of course, inequity affects everyone in society, not just those at the bottom. So it reinforces that gradient argument. And we've already seen the sort of data that Wilkinson and Pickett have presented. Now, the other thing is, I think it's worth looking at other index of well-being, and economic growth doesn't necessarily ensure well-being. And I think these Canadian data suggest that, where you can see GDP rose far more than the Canadian index of well-being. So there's not a clear relationship. And the other data, in public health, there are some famous low-income, high-health countries around the world. Costa Rica is one of those. And if you compare it with its northern neighbour, you can see that they actually live longer. Their infant mortality rates are just a bit higher. In terms of ecological impact, they're doing much better. In terms of gross national income, they have about a quarter of the US, and in terms of health expenditure, far less. So that I really think points to, I think our speaker earlier made the point that it's not the absolute wealth, but it's also what a society decides to do with that wealth. And I think that's a really important thing in terms of thinking about how we tackle health inequities. The other thing, of course, is that we really need to focus on the underlying determinants of health and recognising that those are primarily economic and social, therefore the remedies must be economic and social. And I think that really reinforces why we need a sociological as well as an epidemiological imagination. Very often in health policy, what we do is, and I think this is really well shown in Aboriginal health inequity, is focus on the tip of the iceberg. We look at those visible manifestations of lifestyle, risk factors, of diseases, and we don't look at those invisible factors that are really driving disease and behaviour, daily living conditions, structures, and of course, in terms of Aboriginal people, the colonial history and legacy. So much policy attention will be paid to the fact that Aboriginal people engage in risky health behaviours more than the rest of us. And yet if we dig below the surface, David Thomas and colleagues have shown that if you're Aboriginal, your chances of being a non-smoker are much greater if you haven't been arrested or incarcerated, and if you're not a member of the Stolen Generation. If you're a member of the Stolen Generation, you're much more likely to have smoked. So really pointing to the need for understanding this in sociological terms. Some research we've done at Flinders where we looked at the levels of racism in Adelaide and found really widespread racism. This is people reporting racism in at least one informal setting, and you can see some of the quotes that people made to reinforce that. And we found that among the people we spoke to, the increased experience of racism was linked to worse mental health. And people could talk very eloquently about how that happened. And so for me, any health policy really needs to look at that underlying issue rather than the behaviours that it gives rise to. So that really speaks to the need for us to ask social questions rather than asking why are some individuals obese, asking why do some populations have higher levels of obesity and in some it is rare. So I think that's a really important focus, and so much of what we do in health particularly is asking those individual questions, saying, well, why are these people obese rather than what are the social factors driving that? And in our research at Flinders, we really draw on Bourdieu in trying to understand how health inequities work in local communities and look at the interactions between economic, cultural, symbolic, and social capitals and see how they interact. And I think Jen Scatterbowl's talk will really build on this and will tell a story of kind of how all these factors make a difference to educational outcomes. I think. So that will be great. So what's to be done? And here I just want to look at both national perspectives and international. I spent 3 years as a commissioner on this commission from 2005 to 2008, and we concluded that social injustice is killing people on a grand scale. We had three headline recommendations: improving daily living conditions, tackling the unequal distribution of power, money, and resources, and measuring and understanding the problem. So I just want to have a look at one of those in terms of Australia, thinking about the daily living conditions and what difference that makes. Equity from the start is clearly a really good investment, ensuring that all children have the chance to learn social skills, to learn all the things that are really important. Children's centres in South Australia, I think, are a really good example. I think the uneven distribution of preschool would be a really bad policy example. Healthy places is about recognising that people's health status really reflects the places that they live, probably as much, if not more, than their own personal behaviours. And I think the increased movement to bring health considerations back into urban planning, of course, in the 19th century we did that, is really important. And the lack of public transport infrastructure would be a really unhealthy thing for many places. In terms of fair and decent work, we recognised on the Commission that that's absolutely fundamental. and unfair dismissal legislation would be an example of a good protection, and the casualisation of low-paid jobs, I think, would be something where our employment knowledge network showed that there's a huge evidence base suggesting that that can be really bad for health. In terms of lifelong social protection, disability care seems to be a great example of how we've moved in Australia to provide that. And the income management of welfare payments, I think, raise many issues for people's own empowerment and people's autonomy. And then in terms of universal health care, Medicare, of course, is the great example. And the negative one is the private health insurance rebate, whereby we give over $3 billion of rebates to better-off people in the community. So that's daily living conditions. The other area that we looked at on the commission was about 6 points under that heading of power, money and resources. And we looked at the need for health equity in all policies. And I'll just pick that and say a bit more about that. We looked at the need for fair financing. And I'll look at that in a minute in terms of taxation and health. We looked at market responsibility and the need for effective regulation, particularly of huge transnational corporations, which are having such a powerful impact on our health. We looked at the importance of gender equity, and the very strong evidence base on improving gender equity tends to improve the health, not just of women, but of their families in general. Empowerment we saw as central to good health. Amartya Sen was one of our commissioners, and I'll refer to his work in a bit, but of course he really impressed that improving people's lives is not just about improving their economic lives, but it's also improving capabilities and the amount of power that they have. And we also recognise the need for much improved good global governance. In an increasingly global world, national governments aren't able to regulate or control to the extent that they could in the interests of health. Now, just to pick up on the health equity in all policies, just an example, in South Australia, we have a health in all policies initiative that's facilitated by the health sector, but with direction and authority from Premier and Cabinet. The health sector is the catalyst, and they really look at the health impact of a range of policy initiatives and say, how can we make those policy initiatives healthier? The mechanism they use is a health lens analysis. The particular policies that are subjected to that health lens analysis are selected by Premier and Cabinet. They relate to the South Australian Strategic Plan and the current 7 Cabinet strategic priorities. And then they assess a policy area and then propose ways in which that policy could have either less of a health impact or hopefully a more positive health impact. And examples are in industry, education, and migration, regional migration. At the moment, there's about 20 of those health lens. Now, the other commission headline was about measuring and understanding the problem. And I think Australia does well in terms of measuring the problem. AIHW do a great job. Obviously, the Australian Bureau of Statistics. We have social health atlases. But I think that NHMRC does not take the funding of the H in its name very seriously. It funds the medical very generously, but it really funds very little that looks at positive health. And I've actually been working on a project with the Academy looking at that, and there is actually a report on the Academy website about that. And I just note that in this year's outcome of all project grants, only 45 were funded under public health. That's less than 7%. And many of those were about improved treatments of diseases, not about social determinants. So I think our national body has a long way to go in terms of looking at the H in its name. Then moving on to look at the barriers to reducing health inequities, I really want to look at health policies that don't deal with the underlying causes and the need for more regulation, look at the importance that we currently have targeted rather than universal policies. Empowerment's obviously not central to many policies. We haven't reduced increasing economic inequities. I don't think I need to say much about that. And the importance of taxation for health and the need to increase the fiscal space for health and the lack of political will for redistribution. And I think that's a really important issue that, that's become very evident in many OECD countries. In terms of health policy, Much of our health policy currently focuses on the curative and the rehabilitative, and it does much less on the preventive and even less on the promotive. And on the Commission, we argue very strongly that we really need to focus on prevention. So in terms of diabetes, that would really be about encouraging a healthy food supply, maybe looking at taxes on high fat, high sugar food and drinks, and developing high exercise suburbs where exercise is built into the fabric of life. Regulate for health equity, I think, has become a very, the nanny state rhetoric of many of the right-wing think tanks has made people very wary of regulation. But I think it is essential and should result from systematic assessment of health and health equity impacts across government. There is a real tension between business profits and health requirements. Transnational corporations are powerful and they really influence our government agendas systematically. And investment treaties now open up the possibility of companies suing governments for new public health regulations that might put a dent in their profits. And we saw that over the plain paper packaging, where the tobacco companies tried to do that. And I'm sure Simon Chapman will be saying much more about that tonight. Margaret Chan of the World Health Organization has made the point that many of these groups have strong vested interests that include front groups, lobbies, promises of self-regulation, lawsuits, and industry-funded research that she says confuses the evidence and keeps the public in doubt. And I think that's very true. The other thing that's really good for health equity are universal policies as opposed to targeted policies. It avoids two-tier systems. The middle class have the vested interest of the quality of the service. And you can target within universal provision, which Michael Marmot, who chaired our commission, has called proportionate universalism. Empowerment is also essentially part of how we solve health inequities, making the point that equity is not just about poverty, it's also about capabilities and enabling people to live flourishing lives. It's about psychosocial empowerment and political empowerment. Inequities, we've heard already, are continuing to grow. We've also know that the income gaps in Australia are amongst some of the highest in the OECD. The other thing, in my book, The New Public Health, I argue that I think taxation is a central health equity issue, that we need to see taxes as investments in public services for the common good. There are many tax havens. The transnational corporations use aggressive financial structures and schemes to minimise their tax payment. We saw the fate of the mining tax in Australia, where some of the 1% were able to use their power to effectively argue against that tax. And yet, what I think we need to do is really increase the fiscal space for health that we have for health action by seeing taxation, I think, as the price of civilization, if you like. And then another really vital thing, I think, is that evidence is never enough in this area, and there really needs to be political will for redistributive social and economic policies. This is a quote from Monique Bejan, one of my fellow commissioners, and she made the point that inequity is a moral category rooted in values. It's not just about data, it's essentially about values embedded in political reality and the negotiation of social power relationships. I just wanted to note that the Senate did have reported earlier this year on a standing committee on community affairs, which looked at Australia's response to the Commission on the Social Determinants of Health, and it did make 5 headline recommendations, which included really pushing the health for all policy, the health in all policies approach, having one agency to address issues across portfolios, that the NH and MRC should give greater emphasis to social determinants and annual progress reports to Parliament. So far, there's been very little take-up of the recommendations by either party. Then just to finish, I think, you know, I see action on health equity as a nutcracker with a sort of top-down action in terms of policy, but also, importantly, community action demanding health equity. And we've certainly seen that in the protests against the 1% movement. Just want to give 2 examples. First of all, the Social Determinants of Health Alliance, which has been formed earlier this year, was launched in Parliament House in February. It has over 50 organisations and peak bodies. And Liz Callaghan's here, who's been driving the secretariat. Where's Liz? Is she? Oh, maybe she was here at coffee time. Maybe she's had to step out. But that's a great alliance. And if you're interested in equity, it's great. Well, there she is at the back, wave, yeah, so people can talk to Liz. And the People's Health Movement, which I'm very involved in, is a global network for health activists who are focusing on social, economic and environmental determinants of health and working globally and looking at the massive inequities globally as well. So I think cracking the nut of health equity is going to require that sophisticated understanding that's as much sociological as epidemiological. It's going to require a spirit of redistributive social justice, which drives political decision making. It will require concerted whole of government action. This isn't just something for the health sector. This is something across government. I think it's going to require a willingness to regulate and tax for health and see tax as something that is beneficial for all of us. And I think we're going to have a lot of civil society pressure to achieve the above in a world in which inequities are increasing. Thank you.
Keith Hancock, I thoroughly enjoyed that, Fran. Just a minor correction first. One of your slides, you had the top marginal tax rate in Australia now below 40%. In fact, it's 47%.
Yeah, okay.
I didn't want to speak to make that point. What I did want to take up was an earlier slide where you referred to the social ill effects of rising inequality and including increased crime. Now, there's been quite a lot of attention paid recently to the fact that in America and Europe, and I don't know the position in Australia, there's been a quite dramatic fall in crime rates at the same time as inequality has been rising. Do you have any light to throw on that?
It's tricky because at the time that crime rates, I didn't realise there had been a dramatic fall. I'm sure there's a criminal, Adam Graycar's here, might know if he's still is interested. A dramatic fall, yeah. In certain types of crime, that's what I mean. I mean, I'm not sure that across the board. And of course, the other thing that's happening is a massive increase in incarcerations across the, you know, so we now have chances, I think, of a poor black in America going to prison is greater than they'd go to university, for instance. So I think it's a complex picture of you know, what crimes are increasing, which are declining, and interspersed with how we respond to people who have committed crimes. I don't know if that's, or did you have a particular point you were thinking of, Keith?
No, I think it's a great mystery.
Yeah.
But it does call into question, I think, that the idea that increasing inequality will of itself produce an increase in crime.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the arguments that's been put forward to explain the Wilkinson data.
David Peets from Griffith Uni. Just on that particular point, I've seen a few studies recently that have shown a very strong relationship between crime and lead poisoning. And both comparisons between cities and comparisons within cities over time within the US show a drop in crime rates coinciding with the banning of lead from petrol and from paint. And of course, your exposure to lead through old paint and through being proximity to lots of traffic is itself been related to socioeconomic status. So I think it doesn't really undermine the argument about inequality. It's just one of the aspects of the causes of crime that needs to be taken into account.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
Fran, that was a lovely presentation. Thanks. But part of what you're calling for is, I think, greater social empathy, connection, cohesion, so that we feel more as part of a group than we do just focusing on the individual and the personal advancement as we see it ourselves. I'd like, if that's a correct interpretation, to get your comment on the work that believers out there suggesting that societies that have a high proportion of migrants are less likely to have those qualities of social cohesion.
Are less likely?
Less likely to have those qualities of social cohesion and the sense of the group and the collective as distinct from the individual, and the extent to which that is an issue for Australia.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's a difficult one because it goes to the heart of social capital, and you know, the social capital literature points to the problems of highly bonded communities too, and argues that it's bridging social capital that really, you know, gives people benefits and resources from social capital. And one would think that a community with a higher in-rate of migrants might have, you know, might, if it does it well, as Australia has at some times in its past, have higher rates of bridging social capital as opposed to bonding. And I guess, I mean, the main thing it seems to me, the political agenda is about this issue of commitment to redistribution as a political goal. And we recently just completed a study where we interviewed 20 former state, territory and federal health ministers and asked them how well they thought they'd done in tackling health inequities when they were health ministers. And a number of them bemoaned the fact, they actually said, well, in the 1970s, it was all much easier because I think one of them said there was a generosity of spirit about redistribution about. And I think we have to ask, well, why was that there? Where's it gone? How can we get that back? Because the health minister said that made it much easier for them to bring in Medicare, to do the things that really make a difference to health equity. And they clearly saw that as one of the, you know, if you're interested in health equity, then the political task is to rekindle that generous spirit of redistributive justice. Well, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, Sue's saying, is that harder in migrant societies? I don't know. I mean, if you look at, you know, that period that we saw in all the slides of Australia getting more equal, that was a period of high migration in Australia. So I'm not sure that I necessarily think there's a correlation. I mean, I think it's the political leadership you have around migration and how much we welcome people or don't welcome people, how people get integrated into society. You know, there's a whole lot of other considerations. Again, we need to dig down to the sociology of that, I guess.
Just very quickly, yeah, thank you very much, Fran. The question about crime rates, part of that's explained by demographic change, part of it.
We're all getting older and too old to commit crime.
We commit different crimes as we get older, yeah. Some of which are legal. To give you a direct chance to comment, those of us living in this government town have been seeing a kind of community explosion of anger against the nanny state.
Against?
The nanny state.
Right.
It's in the papers and so forth. It doesn't matter what it is.
Yeah, yeah.
About barbecues or food or whatever. So how do you reconcile a regulatory approach and a community-responsive approach to this kind of backlash? How do we address it?
Well, I mean, I think it's essentially an ideological issue. And I think that, you know, there is an ideological, and I suspect Simon might talk a bit about this tonight, will he, Simon? I don't know. But he may or may not. But, I mean, I think, you know, I think the idea that regulation isn't good for us is a bizarre idea. Simon got a list of 150, he just did a quick email to people saying, what's been good for us about regulation? And when you look at what it does for us, wearing seat belts, obeying traffic lights, I mean, it's absurd. And that's, I guess, the worrying thing, that it has been possible for there to be an ideological move against regulation, when regulation is so good for our health and has helped us achieve most of the health gains in the 20th century were achieved through regulation. So I think we just have to do a better job of selling that and not just accepting the nanny state arguments. I mean, you know, every regulation that's been introduced, people said, oh, this is an infringement of individual liberty at the time. You can almost guarantee 5 years later, everybody just does it and doesn't give a stuff about the individual liberty.
I think I might have forgotten my substantive question, but on that migration point, should we not pay more attention to the criteria by which we select migrants? Because we never select for community spirit. We select for how much money you can pull out of Cape Town and put into Australia, or whether you can slide easily into a corporatized, globalized job from Dublin when the economy goes bust over there. And I've had personal experience of trying to be involved in community initiatives in a suburb 10 kilometres from here, and some of the most difficult people, no matter what their ethnic background, to involve in those activities are fairly recent migrants. Doesn't matter if they're Bavarian or from Malaysia, they're just not interested. It may be different with people who've come in on the humanitarian program, and maybe that explains some of what happened in the 70s. The other thing about that community stuff is to get a lot done in the community, you actually have to have people there, and there isn't anybody there anymore. Mm. People like me are helicoptering the next generation when, you know, and doing it occasionally when we can, but there's just not anyone on the ground anymore. Everyone's in the workforce, so I'm not quite sure how you will achieve that in Australia. I think my substantive question might have been along the lines of, would there be anything wrong at the top end in just letting life expectancy drop a bit for those people in a country like Australia?
I don't know that. Well, I mean, I don't know. I think that was more a comment than
a question. Was Jeff Harcourt wanted to say something?
Yeah, I just wanted to contribute an anecdote from a letter to the Times in London in 1848 about freedoms and heinous restrictions on freedom that were imposed, you know, by the sanitation people. And the writer said that there's nothing that a man hates more than being washed against his will, his walls whitewashed and his pet dung heaps cleared away.
Yeah. But he did have some individual liberty about it, of course.
I think we should thank Fran very much.